and gentlemen.
Can I please have your attention?
Can you dig it?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by The Dispatch and Dispatch Media. Come on by, check out our wares, all that stuff. Also, like, good reviews, good yada, yada, yada. So we're doing this a little different. We are in the Dispatch studio, which is very exciting. We're going to do this as another one of these sort of drive time things. And it's a little uncomfortable to me because I actually have to look people in the eye, which I'm not good at. And I'll let you know if I get a nosebleed from it. And so we have here in studio, we have the Dispatch's own Ryan Brown. Hello, Ryan.
Hello, hello.
And we have in the United States, on our own soil, straight from Hogwarts, none other than Guy Denton. Welcome to America.
Well, thank you, Jonah. It's wonderful to be here. Finally home.
So I think I told both of you guys this separately, but I haven't said it on the podcast. I actually, partly because of COVID, I had would have very vivid COVID dreams.
Yeah.
And I had a very weird COVID dream where I realized that having never met Guy in person, I actually didn't know what size he came in. And I thought that he might actually be, so I had this weird dream that he actually might like be a homunculus, just a miniature human being. And the video feeds we got on the Zoom calls, like you can't tell from scale. And for all we know, he got like miniature like dollhouse chairs and
It's like that scene from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Remember when they're in the TV studio?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And then, like the Oompa Loompas shrink down and then the kids shrink down. That could have been what we had going.
Exactly. It could have been just forced perspective, whatever it is. And so I was a little relieved to find out that he was relatively human sized.
Shockingly tall, if you ask me.
Yeah, a little taller than I would have thought.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a little more Harry Potter-ish, seriously, than I really
am. Oh, really?
Well, the glasses are very Harry Potter.
You're wearing like Gryffindor colors right now, too.
I guess I am. Yeah. Well, this is impeccable English style, Ryan. Don't be jealous.
Well, I am jealous.
Island,
so. I am jealous.
So listeners should know that as of now, Guy is sleeping on Ryan's couch in the basement.
After weeks of saying that there was no way that was going to happen. I get a text. We actually found it this morning on the ride in. We got a text from Caleb saying, hold on, let me find it. I screenshotted it. It said, this is to everyone in the house, which is like three other guys. Caleb says, Guy, Jonah's RA just texted me. He's flying to DC on Friday, but his lodging fell through. Anyone opposed if he crouches on our couch for a bit while he gets settled? And I was like, for weeks now, we've been joking that this is not allowed.
I should clarify, it's in the living room, not the basement.
It is.
Oh, is it really?
It's not a basement. The basement, there's no room in the basement. We do have a dungeon, actually, type thing that we could stick you down there.
Well, Jonah specially constructed a dispatch dungeon back in England that I was staying in.
So that's right.
That's going to go to waste for some time now until we find a replacement.
So this is not actually your first time in America, right? You've been here before.
I have, yes. Yeah. This is not the very. I've never been to Washington before, though, so that's been surreal.
So tell us about your wonderful journey.
Well, wonderful is wonderful. A loose term. Yes, very relative. I'm not sure how far back we want to go with this, but I think people at
home...
When
were you born?
Well, yes, since I was 4 years old. It's quite accurate, actually. But people at home, many of them probably, and fortunately, won't know or appreciate, just because they won't have had any exposure to, how nightmarish and difficult it really is to immigrate, even through work. It is an extremely involuted, restrictive process.
Involuted? That's a word?
Yes, it is. A highfalutin Buckley-ish kind of word.
It's fancy English.
I know convoluted, but involuted?
Involuted is
listening. Keep talking while I look up.
A live fact check. Get Dent. Well, we should have brought Dent.
I think I got that from the Buckley the Doll debates, actually. But
why not just use convoluted?
Well, because it sounds better. Why did Bill use ridiculous words like sesquipedalian?
Because he was sesquipedalian.
He earned it, guy. He's brand new to this country.
This is funny because I was listening to the Emergency podcast for AO about the Supreme Court thing. You know, our niche legal podcast. Mm-hmm. And Sarah, to my shock, not dismay, but shock. You know, it's weird. You're supposed to say shock and dismay, but sometimes it's just shock and nothing. Had never seen the word agglomeration before. She knew conglomeration. And then she went down a deep rabbit hole about what is the difference between agglomeration and conglomeration. And it seems to me, I mean, I never really thought about it that way, but my instinct sounds like it was correct, is that agglomeration is more of like joining together random, non-connected thing, and conglomeration is bringing together things that are related to each other or belong together. But anyway, I looked up involuted just now, and it means complicated or abstruse, sort of like this conversation so far. And I got to look up why it's different than convoluted.
But I think they're just synonyms. I don't think there is any substantive difference.
That's what I mean. Like, you could have just gone with the word everybody knows, but you chose not to.
I did, indeed.
I respect it.
But, well, now I've lost my place, so you can cut this, Ryan. But yes.
The process is convoluted.
The process is convoluted, yes.
And involuted.
And involuted. Yeah. Uh-huh. And many other words that end with voluted, probably. Everyone at home will likely remember the thousands of people who are invested in this, but this all started back in August, and it has dragged on for some time. And one of the many challenging aspects of it is that if you're
the trial by combat,
yes. Well, I passed that. Uh-huh. That was fine. I had my mace and shield, spike shield.
It's really a shame that you had to kill that Welsh invalid who wanted to come here to be a doctor. Contribute to this country.
Two men enter, one man leaves. Joe, I don't make the rules.
But sucks for you, would-be heart surgeon. I'm going to go look up articles on the internet for Jonah Goldberg.
That's right. Yeah, I'm going to write movie reviews for this startup in a basement. It's terrific. But the visa I'm on is a 3-year working visa called
How did this happen?
Cool. Prima facie evidence our immigration system's broken. Anyway,
who do you know?
A 3-year visa called H-1B. The good thing about it is it's something called dual intent, which means you can use it to get a green card. If anyone from AEI is listening, please use it to get the green card. But the funny thing is, and Jonah and I discussed this a few months ago when we were both getting a bit frazzled by the whole nightmarish process, it's fortunate that I'm working for Jonah through AEI and not through the dispatch. Because to get an H-1B, unless you're applying to an institution like a think tank or a college, something tangentially research related, I believe it's just research connected institutions, then it is even more difficult to apply than it was for me, mm-hmm. because there is a lottery component to it.
Right.
You can only apply at a certain time of year, and the petitioning is, and there's also a cap. There's a cap on how many people they take as well.
You were going to say that also the trial by combat actually involves skilled fighters.
It does. It probably does.
Which would be a problem.
And booby traps and pits of flame and so on. But so to do it through the dispatch, I think, would have been borderline impossible.
Yeah, no, we explored it briefly and decided it just wasn't worth the effort to bring you to America.
It sure was.
For the dispatch.
But through AEI, thankfully, AEI is exempt from all of that. So it was just a laborious process in more conventional terms.
So I've been joking about it, sort of mostly joking about it. is it actually literally the case that if I fire you, you get deported?
I'm not exactly sure.
Man, how is he supposed to answer that?
We're not joking, really. But we're sort of joking. I honestly don't know.
Uh-huh.
I think on the visa in my passport, it says American Enterprise Institute on it.
Uh-huh.
I think because the visa's 3 years, and let's say I was with you for 2 years, then wanted to move on to something else and couldn't take the abuse anymore.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure how it would work or whether it would even be possible. I think the visa would have to be renewed by the other employer, but they wouldn't have to go through nearly as much bureaucratic kind of aggravation, I don't believe. But hopefully a green card is forthcoming, though, eh, Jonah? So it shouldn't be an issue.
I tell you, like, on my list of priorities right now, like, doing the paperwork for your freaking green card is really low.
He got you here. It's up to you now.
Okay, so how do you like DC so far? Have you seen much of it?
I have not done quite as much of exploring on foot as I've wanted to, although I have. Well, actually, you
know, been here, what, like a week?
Since Friday, last Friday. But the cold, I don't think it's cold at all. I think it's really quite tranquil compared to how it was back home. The difference here is it's more of a drier, raw sort of cold than a damp, pervasive rain English cold. So to me, this is all right. This is like May.
Yeah, I mean, like last weekend, though, it was in the 20s, and it was legit cold.
It was like, yeah, I mean, I'm from Michigan, and like the last few days, it was like legit cold. I was walking around like, oh, wow, this is like actual cold.
Today wasn't bad. I didn't think it was so bad. I really didn't. I was pleasantly surprised.
It's like in the teens, man.
I will agree that humidity makes stuff feel so much colder. Like, I'm sure I've said this before, but like my wife, who grew up in Fairbanks, Alaska, and would regularly experience 40 and 50 below zero.
Right.
Still said that Chicago was the coldest place she'd ever been because that wet wind that comes off of Lake Michigan that just cuts through any natural fiber. Like, it feels like you just got out of the shower into some sort of Swedish backyard in Chicago.
It's like a running joke in the Midwest. It's kind of like a meme, like a verbal meme, I guess. It's like, well, without the wind, it wouldn't be bad. Yeah. People say that all the time.
It was like in those jackwads in Arizona. And look, I like Arizona, but like, stop telling me Phoenix is just a dry heat. Because first of all, in Phoenix, it's not a dry heat. They have a lot of humidity in Phoenix now, in part because of gardens and swimming pools and whatnot. But like 115 degrees is hot. You know, it's a dry heat in a pizza oven too. You know? all right. So anyway, so you haven't been able to see much.
I've been doing quite a bit of walking around downtown back and forth from AEI. And one of the quite striking things to me, and I've said this to everyone who'll give me any attention because I'm starved for it, is how quiet the streets are after it gets dark.
Yeah, and that's partly a COVID thing.
I'm sure. Yeah, and how also everything empties out and all of the, even on, I think the night before last, I met up with someone and went to a restaurant / bar not far from here. And when we got in, there was a big group of people at a work party or similar, other groups around. And by about 7, it had completely emptied out and all of the staff were visibly waiting for us to leave so they could get going. And even when you're walking the streets around that time, you only really see people by themselves with their heads down, which compared to London, where it's perpetually heaving, is a bit not off-putting at all, just a bit striking in a little minor culture shock sort of way.
So again, COVID, I think, is a big part of that. But DC's downtown is very much like a lot of Midwestern cities' downtowns. After happy hour, people go home. Like, there's no reason to stay downtown. Sure. But there's also, like, so there's this ancient rivalry. You know, I always joke about the Cornell-Harvard rivalry that everybody at Cornell knows about and nobody at Harvard knows about. there's a similar thing going on between D.C. and New York. I don't know if it's still the case, but like in the 90s when I first came here, I was one of these quasi-obnoxious people.
No,
I don't mean generally. I mean about a certain argument where I would say, I'm not staying here. I'm going back to New York. Yeah. I'm a New York guy. This isn't a real city, all that kind of stuff. And like DC people have historically had, Pod actually wrote a really good essay for this, like for Time magazine, like 25 years ago, have a chip. DC people have a chip on their shoulder about New York that New York people could not give a rat's ass about. And I think part of it is that New York City's real competitors as for cities are London, Paris. There was a time I would say San Francisco, but San Francisco has gone south. Chicago, I think, is a much better city than Chicago's orders of magnitude better a city than, say, LA.
I love Chicago.
For like walking around and stuff.
Yeah.
But like New York is a 24-hour city. DC's always basically been a 12-hour city.
Yeah. Bars closed. I mean, eventually. Even on the weekend, like you can go out pretty late, but you gotta go home eventually.
Right.
And I gotta say, like we used to joke about this a lot. You know, I used to hang out at this, I don't think it's around anymore. This place Toledo Lounge and Adams Morgan were old friend, briefly girlfriend of mine, opened it with her sister. And I spent a lot of time and a lot of money at the Toledo Lounge in the 90s. And the thing is, DC bars, I assume it's still the case, have to close by 2.
Yeah, I think so.
Really?
And New York City bars have to close by 4 for the most part, unless they have a special kind of license. Those 2 hours are actually, you're
considerable.
Very, very few good decisions are made after 2 a.m.
I'm very grateful that DC bars have to close at 2 and get dragged home.
Post-COVID, I mean, DC's becoming more of a real city since I moved here anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, there are like, there's some good restaurants now.
Yeah.
And Adams Morgan is, and some of that Columbia Heights stuff is more interesting than it
is. Yeah, I mean, there's
Adams,
pockets.
Adams Morgan, I walked through Adams Morgan last night for the first time. It actually reminded me of England.
Yeah.
Like the sort of high street you'd see in like a, there's a town in England where my mother is originally from called Bournemouth along the coast. And it really reminded me of the high street in Bournemouth where all the nightclubs and restaurants are and things like that. Looked exactly like it.
That's why I lived there for the first 10 years I was in D.C. is because it was the only place that reminded me of New York. Because, like, I get really nervous by quiet. And, because I grew up on 84th and Broadway. And, you know, you'd hear the cars and the buses go by and people screaming and all that kind of stuff. And not always screaming in terror, but, like, screaming. Yeah. And quiet freaks me out. Like, quiet makes me really nervous. And they're basically all the neighborhoods in D.C. for the most part when I moved here, except for Adams Morgan, were quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And Adams Morgan felt like a real city to me. All right. So anyway, I keep interrupting. What are the things on your must-do list other than, you know, keeping in my good graces? Now that you're in America,
am I allowed to have other things on the to-do list?
We've had this conversation. I've told you, you have, you know, in your free time, as we figure out how to define
by 2
it.
Hours a week.
That's right.
Any time away from my house is strongly encouraged. Right.
Before we get to that, so how is he as an unwelcome roommate?
He's taken over. I can't do anything. I
think 1812 all over again.
I think at one point I texted you, if you touch anything besides the door handle on our couch, I'll kill you.
That sounds legitimate. Yes, I think I probably would have been doing it.
No, seriously, I'm glad he reached out and had a place to crash. But there's now 5 people in this house.
That's terrible.
So like, it's just a lot, but it's fun. It's fun.
We do all more or less come and go and shower as well at different times. So it's not very...
There are 2 full bathrooms, which helps immensely.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But I think every time I come home and like see his stuff and him on the couch, I'm like, this is just so funny to me.
It is pretty funny, actually.
I can't believe it.
One of my best friends from college lived in D.C. for a while, and I can't remember why he lost his apartment or moved out of his apartment, but he was apartmentless and low on funds. And so he went to a hostel. You know, I think Julia's Empanadas is still around in Adams Morgan. Anyway, it was above, it was the build, that building above it. And, I went to go visit him at this hostel that he was staying at. And I walked to his room, which he has padlocked with his own lock that he had put on it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, dude, what is that smell? And I don't mean this in any racist way, because like, you can pick people of any nation, you can pick men of any nationality and put 30 of them in one room and it'll smell bad.
But
it just so happened they had a room with triple bunk beds.
Wow.
And literally like a couple to 3 dozen like Nigerian immigrants all living in one room where they have to step, they have to crawl across the other person's bed to get out of the room. And I was like, this doesn't feel sustainable to me as a place for you to live, dude. But I didn't offer him to stay at my house either.
Of course not.
Just so you know, it's a policy thing. So
we don't have a smell yet.
No, we don't.
You could go nose deaf though.
Yeah. Just
be oblivious to your own smell.
Yeah, exactly.
It happens.
I wouldn't doubt it.
So what is the stuff that you really want to see that you haven't yet seen?
I still need to do the full run of the mall. I walked around the Capitol on the Saturday after I arrived, but otherwise I still need to go to the Lincoln and Jefferson memorials, still need to do all of the museums, still need to properly go to the monument, And then I need to explore all the other neighborhoods. I still haven't been to Georgetown and Thoggy Bottom. Still haven't been to some around some of the ones. Well, if there's even any point in going to any of the ones a bit more north.
I mean, Georgetown's worth seeing, but like Foggy Bottom is like
Yeah, we were talking about this a little bit. Like, you're kind of obsessed with Georgetown. And
it's not what you think it is.
It's a little overrated. It's just expensive. And like, I know, it's a cool street.
But it's also funny. It's like every now and then I'll tweet something about, like, I remember once I was like, I tweeted that I was at the Petco in Georgetown.
Uh-huh.
And all these like MAGA Goldberg hater types start tweeting at me. It's like, of course you go to a Petco in Georgetown. What, do they only have poodles?
Yeah.
And it's like, you know. It's,
it does have that kind of like.
It's not that fancy.
No.
And there's a lot
It's nice. Like, there's nice stores, but like, there's nicer parts of.
Like, so you know how, all right, so lower Fifth Avenue, New York, parts of the, I can't remember, it's not the Champs-Élysées in Paris, but it's one of those kinds of streets. And there are the streets in London that have like going out of business sale, buy this carpet, yes, 50% off kind of thing. Georgetown has a lot of that in it too. And it's got a lot of like hoagie places for Georgetown students. It's not, it is not the fanciest. It's not the seventh arrondissement or something like that. It's just a crappy place to drive through because the traffic.
Oh, it's horrible to drive through. There's a couple good bars. Georgetown Piano Bar is super fun.
Yes. Jazz. That's a big thing. I still need to see some jazz. I'm looking forward to that.
I can't help you there.
No, yeah.
We're not known for jazz here. I don't know.
But of course.
I mean, there's jazz places.
This is where
Duke
Ellington came from, Ryan.
Yeah, yeah.
There's the Duke Ellington Bridge you can walk across.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think of jazz when I think of DC, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Are you a big jazz fan?
Jazz, all of that jazz and funk and all of the 70s stuff, yes, inherited it from Dad. So, and a lot of the great, like, Parliament Funkadelic and all of that was heavily DC influenced and based and so on. I don't know if there are any, how many good venues there are nowadays, though, or how many good acts there are. Although, a few things, places to eat are also important. And I should say that this Simpsons thing, these Simpsons articles are actually going to happen. The Dispatch isn't known for over-promising and under-delivering, of course. But two of the great Simpsons writers, a team called Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein, who ran the show for two seasons and were there for a few seasons before that as well, both grew up in D.C. And Bill Oakley is now, in addition to being a TV writer, a social media fast food reviewer who on his who on his Instagram and Twitter feeds posts weird micro reviews of new fast food at just about every place there is in Portland. And since they're both DC natives, he came back to DC not too long ago and put a thing on his Instagram asking for food recommendations and got about 100 replies. So I'll be using that, I think.
Okay. Probably good. It's probably a good map to use. Yeah.
You should at some point go to Martin's Tavern. Have you ever been to Martin's Tavern?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a George Will favorite, isn't it? I think. Or am I making that up?
I don't think. I mean, it might have been when he was younger.
That would shock me. But
It was an old Washington Post, Washington Star, and Kennedy administration hangout.
Yeah.
And it's still got like the Welsh rare bit on the menu and that kind of stuff. And it's a. And it's where a lot of really, like, fading DC WASP, from the WASP from the Ansan regime slowly drink themselves to death. And so it's kind of interesting to people watch, you know, people with, like, belts with ducks on them and red khakis and that kind of stuff.
I think I remember seeing a picture when Bob Mueller was like the guy to see around town. He went to Martin's Tavern with that actor from NCIS that's like the scientist with like the weird glaspies.
Oh.
The guy that you would expect to be a WASPy guy.
Yeah.
With a little bit of an accent. They went there together. And so that's exactly the type of clientele I would imagine at Martin's Tavern.
Yeah. I mean, I love Martin's. I mean,
it's cool. It's a great vibe.
Yeah. And we're very close here to the prime rib, which I believe was the last, I don't know if it's still the case, but I believe it was the last expensive high-end bar, restaurant place that still had old school ladies of the night at the bar, you know, like after 7 p.m. where you could see them, where you could play the game mistress or daughter with a lot of like fat K Street lawyers, where they were like with really attractive young women. Oh. And thankfully, I don't think any of them were daughters, because that would be really gross. Yeah, so, you should go to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Mm. That's very cool.
Yeah. Archives.
Archives.
Cool. Yes, check I that out. Really, archive.
That's cool. That's like my go-to spot for people that come visit. I'm like, well, what should we do? I'm like, oh, you got to go to the archives, because it's a little like, it's not the first thing everyone does, but it's really cool to be in that room and look at all the archives.
All right, we can circle back to some of this stuff, but we should probably do some punditry for like the 12 listeners we haven't scared away or bored to death. Welcome again to America, guy. I really hope I don't have to deport you.
Oh, as do I. I should say that for all of our the loving relationship Jonah and I have on air, we did have a very nice, thoughtful conversation in the office the other day that was a lot of fun. So it's all just a facade.
That's right. I didn't do the full talk, but I gave you a big chunk of the RA talk for or the young person coming to Washington talk.
Yeah. So.
I'm cutting that nice little moment.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah. it's too bad you can't like show how I had my middle finger up in his face the entire time.
Exactly. Just gnarling
polishing
your teeth.
The Singapore cane. Right.
All right. So let's hold off on the rank punditry for 2 seconds. Did anything in the last week's podcasts shock or surprise you, or pique your interest in any way? No.
I think we're going to civil war. and I'm ready. I want to see it. I'm just going to stand on the sidelines. I'm not going to be a part of it, but I think I'd love to see it.
I did feel bad because, like, not only did Ross and David French clash horns on columns like the same week I had Ross on, and I didn't ask him about any of that stuff. David also wrote a book about how we could go have a civil war, and I didn't mention that either. So I was feeling really guilty, but I just didn't know how to bring it up without, like, making it the whole thing. And, and French can fight his own battles.
Yeah, you know? I think he's fine. So Ross had a hard out, and he said there was stuff you wanted to ask him. What was the?
All right. Look, I like Ross. I've known Ross for a long time.
Yeah.
I think Ross is a brilliant writer. But like, one of my frustrations with Ross is his ecumenicism on the right about like his instincts are more sympathetic to this post-liberal integralism than I would like them to be, because I think the post-liberal integralism is garbage, which doesn't mean all of their complaints of the post-liberal integralists are garbage. Like, I'm with them on the porn thing. I think it's entirely legitimate to say we should curtail, not ban, but like curtail porn to its prevalence 20 years ago rather than what it is today.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I'm waiting for there to be hardcore porn on those little monitors on the gas pump. Anyway, so like with Ross, it's just, there's always this, I'm not saying he's intellectually dishonest at all. That's not my argument. It's that he's a good enough writer that he can kind of like, it's like watching a border collie do an agility trial. I mean, he can write clear of all sorts of pitfalls that I think annoy a lot of people who want him to be an ally or an enemy.
Yeah.
Because he just doesn't give the reader something concrete to hang on. And and so like I would love to sort of at some point, you know, strap him to a chair and just interrogate the hell out of him about like what he actually thinks about that stuff.
Yeah.
And and also, I mean, this is totally unfair, but I would love for him to speak forthrightly about his views of the New York Times in general and how it operates. But I understand why, you know, that's unfair to do to anybody. And I'm not saying like he's some special case like this, but it's like everybody I know who works at the New York Times or the Washington Post or whatever, the off-the-record stories are always so much better than the on-the-record stories. Not like the Dispatch, where we're an open book.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
It'd be fun to do more movies and
yeah,
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I did feel really bad that I didn't know anything about his big piece about Don't Look Up.
I haven't read it either, but I thought you guys were largely right about Don't Look Up. I thought it was a funny movie.
I thought there were funny parts.
Yeah.
Thought there were funny parts. I thought, what's his face?
Jonah Hill?
Yeah, Jonah Hill.
He was great. Do you know his prayer for stuff? Uh-huh. Apparently that, like at the end, that was all improv.
Was it really?
Yeah. A lot of the movie was improv.
See, I generally like Jonah Hill. Like in The Wolf of Wall Street, I think he's hilarious. But in that, I just found him annoying. I didn't think any of his lines were funny. It all just felt tedious and smug to me, like the movie as a whole.
Yeah, well,
wasn't that the point, though?
Well, I suppose, but that didn't mean it was fun to watch.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of played out on the movie itself, insofar as like I think it's it fails at what it set out to do, but that doesn't mean that you can't like it for other reasons. And it would have been much better if they had made it all about anti-vaccine stuff, because that actually works as a metaphor. You know, the meteor, the comet thing works as a metaphor. You know, the Don't Look Up part works as a metaphor much better for anti-vax stuff than it does for climate change, for all the reasons we talk about. But I will say, this is not sort of my problem with everything Adam McKay does that's supposed to be serious.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, I can't think out the perfect analogy for it, but like, you know how weird some like action movies seem if there's not like a music soundtrack to it?
Yes.
Or like dancing scenes without a music soundtrack. Like,
yes.
That looks ridiculous, right? Mm-hmm. What Adam McKay does in The Big Short, I should leave The Big Short out of it for 2 seconds because I have not watched that thing all the way through. But like in Succession.
Really? You haven't watched The Big Short?
I watched big pieces of it, but I just never watched the whole thing through. In part because I was annoyed by it and so many people had ranted to me about it beforehand.
Right.
But like if you watch Succession or Don't Look Up, they basically have the exact same dialogue that you would have from Will Ferrell in Talladega Nights or Step Brothers. They just somehow managed to take away that the comedic equivalent of the music soundtrack, right?
Yeah.
So it's like serious people saying these lines seriously rather than the way Will Ferrell can, you know, when like imagine an Anchorman character saying Anchorman type stuff in a serious way.
Right.
But still saying you are a smelly pirate hooker.
Right.
And there's something about the delivery of a Will Ferrell and when it's an explicit comedy that makes that dialogue play differently. And then when you start watching, like in Succession, all it is the same kind of writing where we're supposed to take it absolutely seriously rather than see it as like biting wit and not as comedy. And I feel manipulated by it.
Yeah. The guy that plays Kendall Roy in Succession, I don't know if you saw this, but
there's a big New Yorker
piece about him. And like the author of the piece tries to explain to the actor, I'm trying to get his name, I forgot his name, that like, no, the show's a comedy. And he's like, no,
yeah,
I don't think it is. And he's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure the show's a comedy. And the actor, now the point of the piece is like the actor himself takes himself way too seriously, which is kind of weird.
Sounds like Jeremy Bain Strong from The Simpsons.
But like, he's not even in on the joke.
He's
in the show.
But speaking of the actors, though, that was one of the things I found baffling about it. And I also found it baffling about the French Dispatch from last year as well, where there are so many incredibly famous people in it. And I don't understand why you would assemble that kind of cast and then give most of them next to nothing to do.
Yeah.
Like DiCaprio and Meryl Streep and Jonah Hill obviously all have, Jennifer Lawrence will have significant roles and a lot of material to work with. But people like Michael Chiklis, I think had all of 2 scenes and very little good writing. That was what, I know a lot of people like The French Dispatch. I usually like Wes Anderson. I didn't really enjoy it in large part because I thought there was not enough substance to any of the scenes with all of these great actors in them. Yeah. They just didn't have enough to do.
I still haven't seen it.
Yeah,
but that, that was the sense I got from my wife and daughter who saw it, was that it was kind of self-indulgent.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, sometimes you get those kind of cameo things because someone, you know, Adam McKay calls someone and says, hey, we'd love to have you in it. And he says, I can give you 2 days.
Right.
And they come on and they do some improv. And if it fails, they still want to have a scene where they can brag about how he's in it, but like can't use much of it, you know.
And it gets people in the seats or streaming. I guess. Yeah. No one's in the seats anymore. But. Did anyone been to a movie recently?
I went to the movies last night.
Was there anyone there?
Yeah, it was busy. It was quite a busy screening. I went to see the new Scream, which I thought was an absolute abomination. And I'll try
I didn't even know there was a new Scream.
Well, neither did I until the other week. But I love the old Scream movies, even the one that came out about a decade ago. This new one I thought was awful. And I'm going to try and pound out a review today for the weekend on it. I thought it was so bad. But that was a packed screening. I think it came out on Wednesday. And all of the people there were really loud and into it. You can tell they were big fans of the franchise.
Or high.
Or high. Probably both, knowing this town.
Yeah.
But Spider-Man, I know you really liked Spider-Man as well.
I did. Ryan. I saw it.
So Jonah can't make fun of me for wanting to talk about it anymore. And when I saw that, it was packed.
Yeah,
the crowd was really into it.
Yeah.
So I saw Spider-Man. I thought it was, I think it suffered from all the hype because like I went in with very high expectations and thought it was just okay. Not great. But
see, if you grew up with Spider-Man though, and like you'd seen a lot of the old movies, I haven't seen all of the other universe movies, but like in my mind, Tobey Maguire, spoiler alert, big spoiler alert if you haven't seen it. Yeah, sorry, I didn't get you to get that in there. Tobey Maguire is Spider-Man to me. So when he showed up on screen, I was like, oh my gosh, this is the best thing ever.
Did you scream like a little girl?
How do you know, Jonah?
The real Spider-Man.
Did your audience cheer, Ryan, when they came out?
They
mine did too. Yeah.
Yes.
I find it creepy as fornication that you have the temerity to say to me, if you grew up with Spider-Man, when like, I grew up with Spider-Man. I actually read... First of all, I watched the original Spider-Man cartoon.
I did too.
Religiously when I was a little kid.
That is fair.
And I read, you know, for a while there, Marvel had like 9 different Spider-Man titles. There was Amazing Spider-Man, Spectacular Spider-Man, Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man, you know, all this kind of stuff. I read all of that stuff. And like, you're part of the problem. Is that
that's fair.
You people grow up with these movies and you think that that's like real fandom.
We think we invented this.
I used to read all the old comics. Yeah. I used to have stacks of the old 60s, 70s, 80s ones.
Sure, but you weren't waiting week to week.
Well, that's true.
They had to. That is fair.
But I know I liked it. I still think the single best, maybe the best superhero movie that has come out in the last 10 years, maybe the exception of like the Avengers Civil War stuff was, which I thought was really well done, just impressively done. And I thought Guardians of the Galaxy was really well done, but the cartoon Into the Spider-Verse thing, that was so like, I have a big theory about this. It's like when I was a little kid, I hated like superhero movies because the special effects were so bad.
Oh yeah.
That it just didn't work. And you guys should go find the YouTube clips of like the TV show for Captain America where they couldn't even make the special effects for a guy who basically doesn't have superpowers work. And like even the Hulk was like, I mean, I watched that show, but it was, you know, the Lou Ferrigno Hulk, but it just wasn't great. And then the CGI revolution all of a sudden made it seem realistic that you could have superheroes with these kinds of powers. But part of the problem was is that over time, some of the weird kind of stony magic of comic books got lost because the special effects are so good that they didn't do some of the crazier things. And that Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse thing was the first movie in the new Marvel sort of superhero era that captured some of the fun that comes up in comic books. While still being, you know, a pretty good movie.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of Howard the Duck?
Regrettably.
Okay. So
I haven't.
I've never understood the comic book Howard the Duck. And like, I read comic books pretty religiously. And, but Howard the Duck is just basically a disgruntled middle-aged, just shy of middle-aged dude who's a duck with no special powers who comes to Earth.
That's awesome.
And is just like, smokes and goes to bars and hits on chicks. And was like, and like, I keep waiting for the Shaggy Dog sort of story to end with like Howard the Duck. But like, there are people who love Howard the Duck.
So they made it for the dads of kids that read comic
books. I honestly, I swear to God, I don't know.
Wasn't Spider-Man in one of the first issues of Howard
the
Duck?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, yeah. No, he appeared in all sorts of things. And you're like, guys, he's just a very large duck. One laser beam will cook him. You know, like, what's going on? Never understood. George Lucas, I believe, made Howard the Duck movie, like in the theaters with Leah Thompson. And go on YouTube at some point and look at this thing. And you're like, how did people wake up every morning, get dressed, go to work, participate, like hold up boom mics and like lights and like, set out the craft services table for lunch 5-6 days a week, making this movie without any sense that at the very least they should change their name for the credits, because it is like so. In some ways, it's like a quintessential early 80s movie, just the aesthetics of it. Yeah. Anyway, people should look at it. We'll put it in the show notes. But
I cannot wait to watch it.
It's very strange. And I live in dread that they're going to come out with another.
It wouldn't surprise me. But people forget that the late 90s, early 2000s was an utterly wretched time for comic book movies, with a few exceptions.
That's right.
And now they're going to go back. Undoubtedly, they'll go back and remake Ghost Rider, remake Fantastic Four, all of those. The only one of those, I haven't seen a lot of them in years and years, but the two I always really liked, and I think it will be a shame if they remake, although they probably won't have a choice because Wesley Snipes is about 50, are the first two Blades.
The first two Blades are brilliant,
which
are
I
good.
Think are great. Yeah, yeah.
They're a little bit of the logic of video games applied to movies. Where
the second one, especially,
yeah, yeah, where like in the beginning of the movie, one vampire is hard to kill. Mm-hmm. By the middle of the movie, 10 vampires are hard to kill, and by the end of the movie, vampires are super easy to kill. But the boss level vampire is really hard, and it's like, that was one of the first. Actually, the guy who first pointed that out to me about the corruption of movies by video game logic was Andrew Breitbart. I was about Blade. But that was a long time ago. All right, so punditry.
Yeah.
So people are going to be so pissed about this podcast.
Do we have to?
People are going to be so angry about this podcast. I'm just telling you right now.
You sure you don't want to talk about Howard the Duck some more?
Will you get mean tweets about this podcast?
I don't know about tweets, but we'll just monitor the comments. You'll see. There'll be people like,
I'm afraid to go there.
I work hard. I expect to be intellectually engaged. And you guys are talking about some Harry Potter kids like Visa.
When they see Drive Time, turn your brain off. Clean your oven, whoever does that.
I like that lady.
I know, me too. No,
she always enjoys them. Yeah.
I didn't mean that as an insult.
Okay. Okay.
I think everyone should clean their oven more often.
I feel like it's in my union contract. I have to have a rank punditry in here. So very quickly,
Jonah, what'd you think of Joe Biden's speech the other day?
So I'll say this. So we brought out the G file out from behind the paywall. I got a lot of nice feedback about it. People should check it out. I think I easily could have gone another 2,000 words. I was so annoyed by the whole thing.
Yeah.
But I got to say, I was pleasantly surprised. I was watching Morning Joe this morning. Because I need a soundtrack when I cut myself, and they had this guy Ryan something from No Labels, which I would hope you'd remember if you were Morning Joe this morning.
Dennis Mario,
he was fairly dispassionate about it, and they let him have his say, but he basically made a lot of the points I made in the G file, a lot of points that Yuval's been making, and all that kind of stuff about the utter bogusness of the voter suppression panic, right? I mean, I'm not saying that you can't have you can't criticize some of these laws, because like some of these laws were bad and unnecessary, but this idea that, you know, reverting basically to the voting practices we had in 2018 before the pandemic is the equivalent of Jim Crow on steroids, you know, is shameless, cynical demagoguery. And this guy walked through all of it, and it was really kind of funny how quiet everybody was. Because on MSNBC and on Morning Joe, they have, until this morning, been doing the full voting rights are in peril. How can you be against voting rights? And this guy just basically, without twisting the knife the way I would, or pouring salt in the wound the way I would, you know, this guy's basically like, you guys have been had. This is all hysterical nonsense. Yeah. And I have to say, good for those guys to have him on.
Yeah,
I mean, it's not like Joy Reid's going to have that person on. And although Joy Reid's not going to be on for much longer, which gives me hope for humanity.
Really?
They're kicking her to the curb.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah.
They're
bringing in Simone Sanders, who was,
I didn't know she was going to replace her.
I don't know if she's replacing her, but it was announced the same day. I think it was a way to like placate some people. It's like, look, we got this very progressive other black woman we're bringing in. I think Simone Sanders would be an improvement over Joy Reid, who I think is just grossly irresponsible. There's that.
I've been genuinely more shocked that people are not more bothered by Biden's speech from the other day.
Yeah.
Like I've been on the Hill for most of the week, and I'm forgetting now who the senator was, but it was a Democratic senator. And someone said, a reporter asked him, are you concerned about the divisiveness of the speech? And he was like, no, I don't think it was that bad. And the reporter followed up with, he basically compared everyone that doesn't support these bills to Bull Connor and Jefferson Davis. And the senator goes, well, I don't know if that's quite true.
Yeah.
And the reporter was like, that's literally what he did. I mean, how can you just say that? I mean, to me, it means they just don't want to think about it and think about how bad it actually was.
Yeah. No, there's this guy, Tommy Christopher, I'm not a huge fan of it. He wrote a piece for Mediaite.
I read that. I saw you retweeted.
Yeah. Accusing Jake Tapper of being on the side of Bull Connor.
Unreal.
Because Jake Tapper asked Dick Durbin whether he agreed with Biden's speech, and Dick Durbin said it went a bit too far.
Yeah.
And I think that was the full extent of Tapper's crime in this thing.
Yeah.
And like, I agree with you. I think it is, I think what Biden did was appalling. And the only defense of Biden I can come up with, which I'm not sure is actually applicable, is that someone is that it's basically elder abuse. That someone is filling his head with nonsense and he's going out and parroting it, because what he did was truly indefensible on the standards that he claims to be upholding about the country. And, you know, people change and that's all fine, but like, it takes a certain amount of chutzpah for a guy who played footsie with George Wallace, who was buddies with Strom Thurmond.
Spoke at his funeral.
Yeah, who made all sorts of accommodations to sort of segregation and stuff in Delaware as a young man, and had no problem working with the old bulls who were racists and spoke well of them, to be all of a sudden, and by the way, who are almost all in his party, talking about how Republicans are the authors of Jim Crow and how, you know, that they're on the side of Bull Connor, for wanting to get rid of friggin' drive-through voting and ballot drop boxes, which again, you can have, they're perfectly legitimate criticisms of that stuff, but they don't amount to Jim Crow.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things that really just drives me crazy about, and this is what I was trying to get at with Ross about the sort of decadence of all of this, is that it's like people want to live in more heroic times. And so, let's put it, I'll back up 1 second. So there's one droplet of intellectual substance on this thing. So, you know, as I wrote my first book, you know, and that I was somewhat wrong about, but I wrote my first book that fascism, that the Orwellian jackboot stomping on a human face form of fascism was not in the cards for America, because America didn't have a feudal past, because America was a fundamentally liberal culture, blah, 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 blah.
Tune into last week's Solar Room.
That's right. But I did say that there was a worry about Aldous Huxley's dystopia, which was a society where everyone wants, you know, prepackaged joy delivered to them, like by Amazon. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, like as I always used to say, you know, 10th graders have been given the task of explaining what was wrong with Soma or Brave New World if everybody was happy for years. And I kind of thought that the way you could get to the sort of authoritarianism of classical fascism in America is you first had to go through Huxley's dystopianism, where you basically breed what C.S. Lewis called, you know, a generation of men without chests who felt that they had lost any ability for greatness or meaning in their lives. And so they hungered for it and they started looking for, you know, the heroic man on the white horse kind of thing who would give them some great cause, some sort of ubermenschy kind of cause that, you know, and that's how you could get there. And I think if you look at people like the sort of incel, you know, griper alt-right dorks, you know, what was his, what's his name? Fuentes, that guy who's the head of one of the...
Nick Fuentes, right?
He literally said, maybe I brought this up before, but like he brought up in an, he said in an interview a couple weeks ago, he was asked, have you ever had a relationship with a woman? And he was like, no, but I know enough about women that I can say, and it was like, I come from like a culture, like I forget, like put gay people aside for 2 seconds, where avowedly heterosexual men do not brag on camera about how like they've never been with a woman, right? Particularly like in their 30s. And
well, I had to look this up though. You did mention that the other day. And when I Googled it, I thought, well, how old is he? About 28? He's my age.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So when did he get famous? He must have been about 17.
Oh, so he's only 23?
I believe. I could be mistaken, but I think that's what I saw.
I thought he was a little older than that. I mean, exactly. Look, if you want to take a shortcut to get famous, start making, you know, Jews and oven jokes the way he does, you know, and
ignore women.
And ignore women, right. Women are a distraction. It's sort of like a, you know, like what Mickey tells Rocky in the first Rocky movie is you can't be with any women because it saps your energy for the fight. But but anyway, like, and so I think that there's a there is a danger of sort of having a society where people don't feel like there's an opportunity for glory in their lives, except so they sort of create narratives that make them, that give them bravery on the cheap. And so, there's a lot of sociological literature on how one of the reasons why baby boomers screwed everything up is they were so jealous of their parents' generation because they had World War II and the Great Depression. So they had like great historic mm-hmm. things to struggle in. Mm-hmm. What are we going to do? If you read JFK's, ask not speech.
Yeah.
In that context, it's very much like we are going to create historic circumstances that so that we can live up to the legacy of our parents' generation, in which, you know, where they were heroic on a generational level. At least that's the claim. I hate that generational crap. But and so the baby boomers, you know, they had some like legitimate stuff. So they had like the fighting Jim Crow and civil rights stuff, and that's great. Mm-hmm. You now have kids today who are jealous that they don't have those kinds of struggles on both the left and the right. And so they start inventing them. And one of the things that infuriates me is I think that like part of the problem with Biden's speech, it was in a very real visceral sense, unpatriotic. Because we're supposed to be taking pride in the fact that we have overcome a lot of our racist history and we've made enormous racial progress. And if you're saying that we've made, in effect, no progress, or that we are on the cusp of being no different than the Bull Connor generation, where they put fire hoses and dogs on black people asking for their fundamental rights, then you're basically saying that no progress has been made, that we're not a better country, that we should take no pride in that stuff. We should tell young people that racial progress is impossible.
Yeah.
Because if you're saying that, like, taking away drop boxes is the same thing as, you know, like lynching black people.
Yeah.
First of all, that's incandescently stupid and involuted, but it's also,
it's also just denying part of one of the great narratives of this country. And it disgusts me.
I'm sometimes surprised people aren't more aware of that. Like, this happens on both sides of political spectrum. It was like giving people a reason to go out and vote and give money and all that stuff. Like, how hard is it to just be aware of the fact that politicians are telling you what they know they're going to rally you up this way.
Right.
And you just, I think you're right. I think people need a purpose, and politics is replacing that, which used to be a religion and a family and all that stuff. And it's kind of sad. It's really sad.
Yeah. I mean, look, I have no problem with seeking glory, you know, and what I mean by that is, like, I remember when I mentioned some of this to Guy the other day, you know, I was a television producer for a while. And I really enjoyed it when I was learning a lot and going to cool places and doing crazy stuff with my friends. But eventually I was kind of like, you know, I was desperate to stop working on Ben Wattenberg's TV show Think Tank. Desperate. So I took whatever TV work I could get, and I did some documentary stuff, which I had a lot of fun doing. But mm-hmm. I defecate you negatory. I was making instructional videos with graphing calculators.
Wow.
And doing infomercials for this guy, Oren Harari's book, Leapfrogging the Competition, right? And I hated that stuff.
Yeah.
And my boss at the time, not Wattenberg, but my boss at the production company that I work for, was like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, I'm starting to realize I don't want to be a TV producer anymore. But, you know, he was like, well, what do you want? You know, like, you want to make a lot of money? What do you want to do?
Yeah.
And my answer at the time was a little fanciful, but I was like, glory. Huh. And what I meant by that wasn't like, I didn't want to like conquer Vienna for the Italians or anything like that.
Yeah.
What I meant was, is like, I liked being in the fight and making arguments, and I didn't care very much about making a lot of money. I wanted to make enough money, but I liked the idea of just sort of like, I'm not doing a good job of explaining this, but sort of like seeking, you know, sort of like, you know, Guy wants to be, you know, a writer and all this kind of stuff. It's like, I want to be in the mix, and I want to be
a part,
like,
of something bigger than yourself.
Yeah. And
that's a good way of putting it, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but my problem with the bigger than yourself thing is it's also about like proving that you can lock horns or cross swords with, you know, the best people in the business, kind
yeah.
of thing,
yeah.
right? It's sort of proving yourself. And part of this had to do with the fact that I had a chip on my shoulder when I was younger about having gone to, like, first of all, having been rejected from every college I applied to, but about going to an all women's college no one had ever heard of, right?
Yeah.
And then I go to AEI and I meet all of these like Ivy League, Harvard, Yale, Princeton types, and I really loved sort of the fact that I could hold my own with them. What I mean by this is, what I'm talking about is, like, I got no problem with glory seeking, about being ambitious, about trying to like make a name for yourself and all that kind of stuff. What I have a problem with is like the identity politics version of it, where it's like the people who think that just because they belong to a group, that somehow someone else's excellence or accomplishments through the transitive property applies to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you want to be proud that you're German, be proud that you're German, but like, don't think that like you're a better person because you align with a bunch of other Teutons or whatever. And there's no transitive property. And that's one of the things I love about the pursuit of happiness in the Constitution, is that the pursuit of happiness is an individual right. And everyone is mm-hmm. on to their own about how they sort of get it. And there's a real laziness in the way that the sort of the MAGA nationalists and the sort of Jim Crow 2.0 leftists talk about this stuff, is that they think simply by taking a position that somehow they're doing something heroic.
Right.
Like, you know, I agree with Tucker Carlson. My work is done.
Right.
You've done nothing. There's no work.
By tweeting out, watch this monologue. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, well, that's some heroic tweeting. Really.
Right, exactly.
Like, way to go. You are a hero of our age. It's sort of like my problem with Adam McKay. Is like, Adam McKay says,
If you don't like the movie, it's because you don't care about climate change. And like he thinks he's checked some heroic box about fighting climate change.
Right.
He's going to go back to flying private and all that kind of stuff, you know? And so I think one of the problems that we have is that we live in a time where people think if they subscribe to a narrative that they can cast themselves in some sort of role. I mean, I know I bring it up all the time on here about how I hate the phrase the greatest generation, because it conveys to people who happen to be born in a specific time period accomplishments that they had no part in, right? I mean, like, if you stormed Normandy, great. Right. Good for you, man. Yeah. Like, I'll buy you a beer. Right. I mean, now your doctor probably says you can't have beer anymore, but like, you know, you deserve all the praise you get. But like, if you're just the same age as someone who stormed Normandy and you didn't serve in World War II, why do I have to defer to you as part of the greatest generation? Yeah. There's no transit of property there. And like, but we teach a lot of young people that no, just simply aspirationally, if you subscribe to a certain point of view, that makes you a better person than somebody else. When there's no work involved, there's no effort involved, there's no real glory involved. It's all sort of glory on the cheap. And that's the thing that offends me about so much of it.
Yeah. You see that a lot on Instagram these days. Like people like live normal lives and then they'll put on their story something, some like, There's accounts where it's just like very progressive liberal stuff and they repost it and then they just kind of think, okay, I'm good.
Yeah.
And then like, that's
or you put out a freaking sign in your front yard saying, in this house, we believe in science. Yeah. It was like, okay, well, therefore, you know, like,
which is fine, but
I
like,
can't argue with you about anything, you know?
it's a symptom of I think Ross's decadence thesis is best when it touches on this sort of thing. It's a symptom of a hyper self-sufficient, hyper technological society where everyone is connected, and because of that, in many ways, everyone is in competition with each other.
You see that at
its finest on Instagram.
Probably
many of the people on Instagram are living deeply miserable, lonely, unhappy lives.
Yeah.
And what they derive a huge amount of satisfaction from is posting the best breakfast pic or the best snap of themselves in a hotel lobby or a restaurant to try and one-up their peers.
Yeah.
A lot of Jonathan Haidt's work on the deeper psychological issues at play there says it all.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that's right. And it's and it's weird. Like you go
just a quick, very quick thing about Adam McKay. Speaking of that funny thing about Don't Look Up, I also thought it was hilarious when he made the Dick Cheney movie. What was it called?
Vice.
Yeah. And his argument for why that movie needed to exist was that no one knows anything about Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney is this secret mastermind. And Dick Cheney wrote about 1,000-page autobiography or similar.
Like Dick Cheney has been in public view for 40 friggin' years, 50 years. You know, I mean, it's like, oh, he's a black box. We know it's nonsense. I'm like, our own Steve Hayes wrote a biography of Dick Cheney, you know. But I was just going to say it's kind of like Charlie Cook and I have talked about this a few times. Like one of the most annoying things about the early Trump days was when people would say, do you support him?
Mm-hmm.
As if like there's substance to this question. Yeah. Like you know, it's like, you know, if I support him, does that mean when he says 2 + 2 = 5, I can't say he's wrong? You know, I mean, it's like, it's sort of like in, you know, in Westeros where Guy's from, where the, you know, saying you support the Catholic on the throne over the Protestants on the throne, there's some meat there. Right. But but it's still kind of magical thinking. And so I bring this up because the other day there's this guy from who's some Baptist theological seminary student who had this tweet where he says that I used to be a huge, you know, mainstream conservative, you know, Jonah Goldberg, David French, Rich Lowry fan, and I used to read the G-File, you know, religiously, couldn't wait for it to come out, and now all of these guys have sprinted like Usain Bolt. This is his phrasing. Have sprinted like Usain Bolt to the left.
And
he said that about Rich as well.
Including Rich, yeah. I mean, I thank you for being shocked on Rich's behalf, jackass.
Well, we know what the dispatch is like.
And the thing is like, first of all, I'll let David defend himself. I mean, I think David's become a little more even-handed about some race stuff. Maybe that's because spending 5 years having people tweet pictures of his adopted daughter in an oven being murdered right. does that to you. Yeah. I mean, I who knows? But like,
it'll change a guy.
Like, I pushed back on this, and a bunch of people responded, and no one had anything substantive to say, as far as I could tell. Maybe I missed something. It all boiled down to the fact that I had joined the coastal left wing elites because I didn't like Trump.
Right.
And like, let's say for the sake of argument that Donald Trump killed my cat, right? And I never forgave him for it. Well, how does that make me a left winger? Right. It's like I haven't changed my position on affirmative action, on taxes, on limited government, right. on the Constitution, or any of these kinds of things. And it makes it's this weird sort of cultural signifier that says someone's loyalty to a person is more indicative of your ideological tribe than any of the actual ideological positions
right.
that you take.
Right.
And that's sort of what I mean about this sort of transitive property thing, is it's just sort of like, you know, these people who brag about how much they're a MAGA supporter as if right. that somehow makes them purer about something, when all it makes them purer about is they like Donald Trump's Musk.
Right.
You know, yeah. it's not commitment to any serious ideas or right. anything like that.
Anyway. That's what makes it so dangerous.
Yeah.
For my generation, it's like, it's just a person or a narrative. I don't even, like on the left, I don't know if it's one person, but it's certainly just the narrative of,
well, I mean,
I don't even know what it is.
You were, you know, you were a little yearling during the early Obama days, but it was.
Oh, sure.
The cult of personality sure, stuff sure, about sure. Obama was
yeah, I mean, like,
bananas.
Yeah. Biden doesn't have that same type of following.
No, no.
But I know what you mean. Yeah.
I mean, he's like, it's like he's walked out of a Bartles and James commercial. Like,
yeah, exactly.
It's all the more reason why it's so stupid for him to be pandering to the left right. like this, because he right. has carte blanche to be the boring old man
yeah.
who
right.
just isn't engaged.
Right.
And instead he gets engaged.
That's why
badly.
He won. That's why he won.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't win on Jim Crow 2.0.
Well,
that's
the funny thing about the speech, though, is Biden is what he is. Think of the number of political car crashes that Biden has been in over the course of his entire career.
Yeah.
And yet after all of them, he's the one standing there with no limp,
yeah.
walking
yeah.
off,
yeah.
smelling of roses while everyone else is dying and screaming. And it's the same again now. Biden obviously isn't thuggish and vulgar like Trump is,
yeah.
but he's brusque and he's irascible, and he was throughout the entire campaign. And you see it on perfect display
yeah.
now that he's running the country.
No,
I've
mean,
seen like, a lot of that of like, we tried to tell you on the right, like we tried to warn you, this is who he was.
It's the point that I made a lot about why Trump was the way he was that winner's bias is a real thing for old people. And, mm-hmm. you know, the cartoon I always bring up is the guy who says, you told me to quit. You told me I was being stupid. You told me it was pointless, but I didn't listen. And I kept buying those lottery tickets and I won. Right. There's this well-documented tendency in some third world countries of, you know, people who will like be going up a hairpin drive in the mountains, and they'll almost, and then a school bus will come the other way, and the school bus will almost go over the cliff, killing 50 kids, right? But it doesn't happen, right? It just almost happens.
Yeah.
And the way some people internalize it is, well, this is just how you drive, right? Rather than, man, that was close.
Yeah.
Trump spent his entire life doing things that everyone told him you shouldn't do, you can't do. And he was the black swan at the far right end of the distribution, like the monkey throwing darts at stock picks, who succeeded anyway. And so he's internalized this idea that he'll always be right. Same thing with Biden. Biden is a middle brow dude who, much like, you know, Delta House, has a long tradition of existence
yeah.
And yeah. little more. And he has internalized this as, I am brilliant. And
right.
And I know something that everybody else doesn't know. And I think it's tragic for the country, because he could have been
yeah.
a very successful one-term president
right.
who sort of brought the country back to the center
And instead, I think he's making a lot of things that got him elected in the first place worse. But
I'm actually curious about that Obama point, because I know that there was some friction, where, especially in the NR realm, where Christopher Buckley and a few others embraced Obama, and there were other tensions there as well. But how fractured was the movement more broadly during that time, before, when certainly before when I was paying any attention, and I'm sure before Ryan was as well?
I don't think it was that fractured. I mean, Christopher Buckley was a friend of mine, but he's sort of sui generis on a lot of this stuff.
Yes.
And I tend to be on his side more than not. But I think there were people who, and I think I downplayed it or minimized it more than I should have. There was a weird sort of hunger to demonize Obama as some truly otherized figure.
Mm.
That's where a lot of like the birth certificate, the birther stuff came from. If you read like the Dinesh book on Obama, which Ramesh panned brilliantly, there was this desire to sort of turn him into a post-colonial globalist, demon figure. And I'm not saying there's no merit to some of the criticisms that those people used, because, I mean, I made some of them too. I hated a lot of his verbiage. I hated the messianism of how he ran. But the fractures that Obama caused on the right, I don't think were manifest very much in 2008. To the extent that there were any, it was because Obama, which everyone now forgets, Obama ran as an opponent of gay marriage. He worked really hard at sounding more religious than he was.
Right.
And the real problem was that a huge number of people, I think wrongly, on the right, despised John McCain. So there was I think McCain probably divided that old right more than Obama did. Because there was just some people who couldn't be enthusiastic about McCain. I think wrongly, even though I have, my criticism about McCain. But the real fractures on the way you would say, okay, past was prologue, about Obama dividing the right, had more to do with toward the end of the Obama years than the beginning of the Obama years, I would say. I guess I'd have to think about it a little more. I do remember sitting with Ramesh and a couple other people at a bar when it was pretty clear that Obama was going to win, or maybe he had won. Yeah, it was pretty clear he was going to win. And we were talking about, on the one hand, how great it is for America to have the first black president, which I think it is and was. I really wish it had been Colin Powell in 1996. But on the flip side, that this was a guy people don't remember. He was a nobody state senator. And then the second he won a statewide race against Alan frickin' Keyes, who I will just say up front, bananas. I have stories about Alan Keyes. But and then the second he got to the Senate, he started running for president. So like he had no real accomplishments in politics under his belt. I just remember Ramesh saying, so great, the first black president will be a failed president. How's that for, racial peace or whatever? And I'm sure Ramesh would revisit, the view about whether or not he was a failed president. But at the time, it was a real flyer. And Obama ran a really smart campaign by sort of being all things to all people and benefited there are an enormous number of people who think that being black hurt Barack Obama's chances running for president. I disagree 1,000%. It was an enormous advantage, both in terms of his own strategy, but also in how he was treated by the media. It was very Biden-esque. If you disagree with Barack Obama, it was proof that you were racist. And then what was amazing was 8 years later, if you disagreed with Hillary Clinton, it proved that you were sexist. And even though the disagreements with Hillary were the same disagreements we had with Obama, which were the same disagreements we had with John Kerry, maybe we just disagreed on the merits rather than their gender or race or whatever. Anyway, okay, now we've gone too far All right. So I think we're done here because I am rambling. And now, let me put it this way. Now my rambling is becoming evident even to me.
We knew it was over when guys started to fall asleep. That's like, right. Hey, Jonah, we might want to wrap it up.
I wish he had told me about the heroin addiction before he came over.
I couldn't tell customs that, could I? But
anyway, thanks everybody for listening. And thank you, Ryan. Thank you, Guy.
Thank you, Jonah.
And I got nothing else to report, so I'll see you next time.
No, you won't. This is a podcast. And for the love of God, if anyone has any roommate suggestions, housing suggestions for Guy, please, please send them our way. He needs to get the hell off my couch.